My name is Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. With over 400 million children living in conflict right now, this episode looks at the impact this is having. We speak about the history of blast injury, the statistics of those maimed and killed, and how the military community is working with NGOs right now and in the future. A Save the Children special with Dr. Emily Mayhew, James Denslow, and Dr. Dave Henson. This is Declassified. Emily, if we go back 100 years, what changed then with regards to children in conflict?
Well, 100 years ago is really the site and the time of the First World War. And the important word there is World War. So this was an enormous war fought on an industrial scale across the planet. Most of the battlefields that we know about are in Western Europe, but it was really across the planet, multiple empires involved, millions of soldiers with millions of weapons. And many of these weapons were explosive weapons, were artillery. And so the point at which everything changes because of the First World War is in the real volume and numbers of explosive material that are used, that are discarded and abandoned and left behind, and it could be in the battlefield, what becomes buildings on a battlefield, and the discovery of this kind of material by children. And when children discover explosive materials, they don't run away. They don't put a sign up saying legacy munitions or minefields. Generally, they pick it up and they investigate. And so the First World War really marks this point where children start to die in the aftermath of wars as much or even more than during the actual wars themselves.
So the First World War, immediately afterwards, because obviously then these children are going to a place of safety, but then when they're coming back to these towns, these villages, these cities that have been affected in and around the trenches and the Western Front, they were what integrating back in and playing around the sites of the conflicts, the sites of the battles?
Well, we've got some indication of this from the very early bombing that's done actually during the First World War. So in the north of England, you know, famously, a number of towns are bombed by Zeppelins. And the buildings come down and some of the munitions don't explode. And when people go back in to retrieve their possessions or because they're curious at this new phenomenon, children start picking up explosive weaponry and it can go off and injure them. At the end of the First World War, it's not so much the Western Front, although that is a real issue. It's for the countries that were defeated. So Germany, in particular, is laid waste. Its towns and cities are laid waste. They've already been ruined because the country itself has started to collapse inwardly. There's very little economic support, so its population is starving and its towns are collapsing. And then as the war draws closer and comes to an end, as aeroplanes are used more and more, the cities themselves are actually blown up. They're blown into rubble. And buildings fall, and they fall on explosives that don't go off, and children are left orphaned or isolated from their families. This is really one of the first times in the modern era where we see what we might call a feral gang of children learning to live in the rubble, learning to scrape a living from the ruins of a city. And occasionally, just when they think they might have found something shiny that they can sell and buy food, actually finding a piece of explosive weapons fragment and it going off and injuring them. So many of the scenarios that we recognise today, we would have seen, first of all, a century ago, particularly in the defeated cities in the combatant nations of the First World War.
And with regards to kind of injury and blast injury, what was we looking at in the First World War? Was it larger munitions or was it smaller kind of grenades? What were we looking at?
It was really the full range. We'd developed grenades that could be thrown. You know, again, just like today, you throw a grenade and mostly they go off, but quite often they don't. And then you have shells which get bigger and bigger, which are built with more and more industrially, and More quickly. There's more pressure to deliver numbers of shells. And towards the end of the First World War in Britain, particularly, we know that there are a number of scandals where shells are badly built, where the chemicals in the noses of the shells aren't put in correctly, where there are fires at the factories, but also where the shells fail to detonate where they're supposed to, i.e. on the enemy lines. And they land and they're buried either in the trenches or in the ruins of the building. And there they lie, either with their chemicals leaching out, but more likely with their explosive component still potentially active. And as the metal of the shell piece itself is degraded, then the explosive is exposed, and this becomes an extremely dangerous object waiting to be discovered.
And when the injuries themselves, then, if you got like this pack of orphaned feral children running around trying to get some scrap metal, as opposed to, like you said, to sell for food, were the injuries fatal? Was we've seen a lot of fatalities, or were they amputations? What was we seeing specifically that First World War?
We have very little data from the First World War, particularly from the defeated cities, because everything had pretty much collapsed. So there wasn't somebody taking neat records in the hospitals. But what we can assume from the nature of the munitions that were left behind and the very poor provision, particularly for orphaned or feral children, is that almost certainly when these explosions went off, they probably killed everyone in the group. And I think it's really important to if we can to have that group of feral children in our mind's eye, because it's a group. The real distinction between blast injury in adults and in children is that in children, it tends to happen in groups. So you have 5, 6, 7 children from whatever age where they can walk, when they can scramble over rubble, perhaps led by an older child. When the explosion goes off, when it activates the rubble around it, the chances are that all those children are going to be killed. Particularly, again, in the defeated nations of the First World War, there's not much medical infrastructure to pick them up. They're probably already suffering the diseases of malnutrition, and so their bodies aren't really up to dealing with that kind of insult. So these are almost certainly going to be painful, terrifying, and mostly fatal blast injuries.
Then if we move to the Second World War and the kind of technology leap, you know, in that 20 or so years, and I always remember a story about children playing with cluster bombs dropped in Grimsby. It always really resonated with me because, you know, I was from there, and you think that... you think that children in conflict are some far-flung land, but actually it was in this country just over a generation ago. What was we seeing with regards to kind of bombing in, or local bombing in the UK, and that relationship between munitions and children?
Well, the Second World War is in lots of ways, but in particular in relation to munitions and children, it's a real concentration of the first. So the Second World War becomes very much about the destruction of cities. You know, we're used to thinking about the history in terms of the strategic air bombing campaigns. So when we go out at night and flatten as many German cities as we can possibly manage, and they go out at night and endeavour to do similar damage to UK cities. And the thinking is that this destruction is so awful that it will destroy morale, and that countries will, as they say, sue for peace, that if they see their cities being flattened night after night, they will eventually beg their governments or demand of their governments to sue for peace. And this doesn't really happen. And in the meantime, you see in the United Kingdom, you're not seeing so many feral gangs of children everywhere, but you are seeing situations in the East End where bombs are dropped that fail to explode. Mostly, the civil defence organisations put up a sign. They seek to cordon off these craters where there's a bomb at the bottom. But it's not always possible. Really heavy bombing is incredibly demanding of all the civil services, of fire, of ambulances, of the army that's going to deal with bombs that are left behind. And so the bombs sit there, and children come out of the bomb shelters, where they come out of the tube stations. Perhaps they've had parents or family members who are distracted by the destruction of their house, or perhaps their parents or family members have been injured or killed. And they are left to run in the streets that they used to know. And just like the children in the First World War, just like all children, they're extraordinarily curious. And they want to investigate the crater and climb over the rubble of the wall and play with what they find there. And whether that's the East End of London or the targets for bombing in the north or the Midlands of the country, that's the case. Gathering together a landscape and making it safe is really difficult to do immediately after the bombing. And again, it's children who come out of shelters first, who go exploring to find out what's happened, who don't have that sense of fear that they should have when a wall teeters and may collapse on them, or when they see something shiny, they don't step back and point it out to an adult. They go down to find out what's there, and then they pick it up, and then the explosion happens.
Like, warfare was certainly changing during that kind of 5-6 years. You know, things like mine warfare. You know, we'd spoke about the UK then, but this was a world war. Was we seeing casualties changing across the world, like as in, you know, kids picking up unexploded bombs in the UK, or were children elsewhere in the world getting blown up by mines?
Absolutely. During the 20th century, one of the particularly shameful features of human history is the understanding that laying minefields is a really cheap and effective way to wage war. You're not having to put together a really expensive field army with really expensive field artillery and master the complicated strategy and tactics that a battlefield requires. What you can do is create a field of death relatively cheaply using industrially generated explosives, so mines, and you can lay them and walk away. And the fear that they will strike in the citizens of that country, just from the uncertainty and the destructive potential, is absolutely extraordinary. And the 20th century is where you start seeing minefields being laid wherever anyone who can afford to buy them in numbers can do so. And that could be in thick, heavy clay soil, or it can be in dry desert sands. They're cheap, they're effective, and they last a really long time. And again, these are much like the strategic bombing campaigns of both sides of the Second World War. These are terror weapons. These are not weapons that are going to achieve a limited tactical advantage. They're designed to terrify the population into surrender. And it's the knowledge that it's the very small members of the population who may take the greatest hit of all that's part of that process.
You talked about a terror weapon and you know, until recently with our own soldiers and many, and one who's on this podcast coming up, you know, these things terrified British forces and children played around them and they worked and lived in places like Afghan and Iraq. How has war changed, and how has war been conducted now in regards to kind of state on state? What does that mean?
Well, from the end of the Second World War and the onset of the Cold War, war becomes a much more difficult process to be really clinical in your analysis. It's very rarely somebody versus someone else or a country versus someone else. It becomes about client states, and from there it becomes about civil wars, about territorial claims within or beyond nations. And even today, it's really difficult to talk about whether a war is a state on state. Because depending on your point of view, you might say it's a civil war. You may say it's a religious war. It's a different kind of war. But the commonality that they have is this terror element, is this idea that explosives have either been deliberately planted or abandoned, or people have forgotten about where they've put them. And the people who come after them are the most vulnerable. I think the other thing to remember, and again, something that we saw begin in the Second World War, but really is very much about the wars in our own time, is that war in our own time t- tends to be an urban phenomenon. So the kind of problems that we see from blowing up cities are really compressed in places like Syria and Iraq, where you have big cities with populations trapped in these real corridors of desolation, living with danger every day. If there are shelters, they are rudimentary and having to take a risk with every step that they take.
You know, if we look at places like Southeast Asia or East Africa, and we look at the problems, especially mines, are causing, where you know, there's floods and mines migrate, you know, years and years after, you know, sometimes decades and decades after, and they're still causing severe, huge problems for children. If we kind of narrow down on those issues, those problems, there's the obvious of the injury and the blast, but these secondary problems, things like illiteracy and slavery, can we talk a little bit about those issues first?
Absolutely. So the first thing about mines, or I've talked about mines being cheap and really quite effective. And the second thing is that we know that about them. What we're much less certain about them is what happens to them if they get wet, or if they get very hot, if they dry out. How long are they going to be explosive and dangerous for? And there's no point at which mines don't have a sell-by date on. That's part of their effectiveness. They can be flooded out and washed down a river gully, just as you said. The sandstorms can blow sand away and expose them. But all in all, they remain dangerous. And overall, we try to mitigate that risk as far as possible. When you come down to child on mine, and it's a terrible thing to think about, but I think quite often people aren't specific enough on the details of what happens. If, first and foremost, if that child survives, and if that child is taken to a medical facility, the chances are that they have, much like our cohort, our military cohort, suffered a limb injury. Because children tend to pick mines, with adults tend to tread on mines. So they tend to suffer in their lower limbs, in their legs. Children quite often pick mines up, which means that they can sustain severe injuries to their upper bodies, particularly their arms and hands. So they're going to need, obviously, surgery to save their lives. They're going to need damage control surgery for what's left of their limbs. And then at some point, they're going to need a prosthetic. And the really challenging thing about children is that this is, we always say at Imperial and at Cebus, we need to remember that they're not little adults, they're little human beings. And the really challenging thing is that's the rest of their life right there. The damage that's been done, if they've survived and going forward. The chances are, in most parts of the world, that they're going to be returned to their community, to their family or to their caregivers, and they're not going to be able to go to school or earn money without assistance. The kind of assistance that we take for granted with our disability population in the UK, for instance. You know, our schools are designed so a wheelchair can go in and out of the classroom. Well, that's not the case in most places of the world. And if going to school becomes really difficult, then they're not going to go to school. They'll be put to whatever work they can be given. And any education that they might otherwise have got that enabled them to realise their potential is ceased. So if they haven't learned to read at that point, at the point of their injury, there's a very significant chance that they're not going to learn to read ever again. And so you can say when that mine goes off that this is a child that suffers extreme physical trauma, that they have soft and hard tissue damage, that the chances are they're going to need damage control of missing limbs, and they are going to be made illiterate. And it's all part of the same process. It's a whole life ruined there and then in that moment. But it takes a very long time for those consequences to play out.
You know, we said a few times during this conversation that, you know, munitions and mines and warfare is aimed predominantly at soldiers, although there is a spillover into terrorizing civilian population. But what are we learning from the injuries of soldiers? What are we learning from the experiences of soldiers, especially UK base soldiers in regards to blast injury?
Well, Michael, as you know, I work in the Centre for Blast Injury Studies, and we do exactly what it says on the tin. We study blast injury. Our department was founded 10 years ago because when the very first soldiers came back from Iraq, and in particular from Afghanistan, with blast injury, we could see that the kind of trauma that had been inflicted on them by what were effectively weapons designed to terrorise was really complicated. And it wasn't enough to just use what we already knew about wounding and traumatic injury, but that we needed to create an entirely new field of research so we could understand how to protect people from blast injury, but when they'd had a blast injury, how we could secure their survival and then secure their life beyond survival. And so for 10 years, we've really worked on that cohort, on the UK military casualty cohort, that most of whom have come back from Afghanistan, who were unexpected survivors. We didn't expect them to be able to survive this kind of injury, but they have. And they've, one of the things that's really remarkable for me as a historian is to see how participatory the veterans cohort has been in helping us understand their injury. So it's 10 years after we founded the department. We've really got an extraordinary understanding of what happens to an adult at the point of explosion. And we've slowly come to realise that although there is a significant global adult population, it's the child blast injured population that is much larger. It is added to every day all around the world. And that we need to apply what we've learned from our injured soldiers to the present and future injured children.
James, what's the single biggest threat to civilians in and around conflict today?
Well, Michael, I think what we're seeing is how explosive weapons are coming to dominate modern conflict, and how those weapons can have sort of a reverberating effect, if you will, for civilians and certainly children who are affected by them. So imagine a child who's living in a city who suddenly is near to an IED blast that goes off that could obviously instantly kill that child. And children are uniquely vulnerable to these types of weapons, and they're very different to adults. They're not just small adults. It could severely injure that child, which would cause potential sort of amputations or injuries that would have life-changing effects and would require care that might not be available in the environment that child lives in. That explosion might also take out the electricity grid, which would affect whether that child has refrigerated food or is able to access education, and intent in, whether online or the fact that his school could be damaged, or the fact that his education could be disrupted. So the effects of a single blast go far beyond the sort of immediate carnage that we see in news reports. They go into sort of decades of harm when it comes to the children that we speak to, whether that's children who've suffered, you know, extreme injuries, or those who are dealing with the psychosocial impacts of having to get past a single attack they saw. And of course, some of the statistics are pretty jarring. And we calculate that a single classroom size of children, that's 25 kids, are killed or maimed every day on average for the last decade. And I think that's a sobering thought, but a reminder of the scale of the challenge we currently face when it comes to modern conflict.
So are we looking at things like IEDs, or is it purpose-built munitions, or is it a mixture of both?
Well, I think that's part of the challenge. You see, you've got a legacy of weapons such as landmines, where they still exist, and they are predominantly now detonated by children, those who are, you know, curious and are kind of playing everywhere and finding weapons from wars long finished. And then I think we've seen in the last few decades the sort of exponential rise of the improvised explosive device, which is one of the most insidious weapons of modern war. Obviously, they were designed and purposed by non-state actors and fighting against very well-resourced militaries, and that's what caused huge amounts of death and injury to, say, you know, British soldiers in places like in Iraq and Afghanistan. But at the same time, these weapons obviously are also triggered by civilians. And, you know, it doesn't take much time in Google, let alone the stuff we're seeing from our country offices, to see sort of pressure mounted weapons on teddy bears or kind of brightly colored weapons that children are naturally attracted to. So I think the growth of the improvised explosive device has, and especially when combined with a general kind of global trend in urbanization. And remember, we're looking at sort of over, you know, half the population of the planet living in cities already, and that number kind of going far higher in the next decade or so, that, you know, densely populated cities with lots of civilians in, with lots of children in, and weapons that are designed for the open battlefield and have wide area effects, whether they are sort of repurposed shells or even, you know, airdrop weapons, artillery. If you have very accurate weapons that have a large explosive payload, you may take out a sniper's nest on top of a building in Mosul, but you may also take out the block around it. And if you weren't aware that in one of those buildings there were children that had been welded shut into a basement, which is unfortunately what did happen in Mosul, you're going to see far higher numbers of direct civilian death. But as the point I said earlier, I think we need to start being cognizant that this is not just about the instant point of killing and maiming of children. The legacy goes into decades, and it has sort of geopolitical ripples that kind of go out. So when we occasionally see a sort of family of refugees in a makeshift boat on the Channel, often their story can be traced all the way back to a blast or of sorts going off in Aleppo in northern Syria. So that's the nature of these kind of weapons and the challenge they face.
And just to go over then a few of the points there. So you've got, and forgive me if I've got the terminology wrong, but you've got, you know, over 400,000 children living in and in around conflict at the moment on this planet. Are all those kind of active conflict sites, is that a high kind of impact conflict sites, 400,000 or over 400,000 children?
Yeah, so I mean, I think the way we look at it is you've got sort of almost one in five children around the whole world living in areas affected by conflict. Now, obviously, to be in an area affected by conflict doesn't mean it's a high intensity conflict with over 1,000 battle deaths a year. You know, but even then, it does have an impact on children. So if you're living in an area that has a sort of infrequent cadence of terrorist attacks, say, or incidents, that still has impacts on children that we need to be aware of and be thinking about how to respond to. And you just have to look at how, you know, Western countries have adapted and responded to the threats of, you know, explosive attacks. And I'm thinking particularly of the Manchester bombings, where a large number of children were caught up in that attack. But then, of course, the most high damaging, if that's the right term, conflicts for children are those high intensity ones that we're seeing in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, DRC, Central African Republic, Sudan, just to name a few. And I think what we're seeing is not just urbanization, meaning that the type of weapons that we are unfortunately seeing more and more of in these conflicts are causing more harm, but also that these conflicts are becoming more and more protracted. So what are we looking at? We've got almost 20 years of conflict in Afghanistan. Next February will mark a decade of the conflict in Syria. We've got the Iraq conflict has metastasized, has changed a lot, but there's still sort of active parts of severe instability there. So I think a combination of protracted conflict, the urbanization of conflict, and then also what we describe as sort of the increasing complexity of conflict, which is that gone are the days where you'd have two standing armies kind of going toe-to-toe in a field somewhere in France. Increasingly now we have conflicts like Syria, where you have hundreds of non-state armed groups, of which the command and control and who they are responding to or what kind of mandate and kind of objectives they have is incredibly confused. And that makes things even more dangerous for children who are having to live in the sort of the shadow of those. And of course, remember, when we're talking about this, such a large number of children, you know, every single 10-year-old in Syria will have known nothing but conflict. And that is, again, quite a sobering thought as to how long-term these conflicts are.
I remember the video footage of watching I think he was 3 years old in the back of an ambulance with blood pouring down his face in Syria. It must have been 7 years ago. And just the terror and the fatigue in his face, this little boy, it was so emotive. And that was really that in that high intensity conflict areas. You mentioned a second ago about children getting welded shut into buildings as well. So we've got this high intensity, if we focus on that high intensity conflict areas, how are children being used? And secondly, how are they coming into contact with munitions kind of day to day?
Yeah, well, I think it's a really good question. And just quickly to go back to the story you spoke of that wounded child in an ambulance in northern Syria. I think that's an example of, there's been several images of children throughout the years, whether it's that little girl running from a napalm strike in Vietnam, or Alan Kurdi lying face down in the sand on a beach, that have triggered, you know, incredible responses from humanity generally. I think that, you know, it's a sort of basic response to, when you see a child in peril, to want to help. And it's a basic response to be utterly horrified to see a child who's been hurt. And unfortunately, the fact that that child in that ambulance was able to be shown was because the injuries were relatively superficial. Most injuries that happen to children when these weapons that are designed to sort of, you know, pierce armor or destroy, you know, military vehicles, when those happen to children, you don't see those on the news for very understandable reasons. They'd simply be too distressing. So unfortunately, there is, you know, beneath the surface of those images, so many more that can't be shown. But I think your question pointed to two things. One is sort of the inadvertent harm to children of modern warfare when it moves increasingly into areas where children live. And the second, I think, is more nefarious, which is, and I think that's what the report that we just put out shows, an increasing use of children and sort of targeting of children directly themselves. And in a way, we're seeing sort of the protections that come from childhood itself being hemorrhaged away. And the UN some 15 years ago set up this analysis of looking at grave violations against children in conflict. And I think, you know, they looked at sort of, you know, sexual abuse, abduction, recruitment, killing and maiming, the denial of aid to these children, or the attacks on their schools and hospitals. And obviously, when you're looking at killing and maiming, and we're talking about weapons that that simply kind of children are caught up in, but of course, then you go back to the sort of how these weapons can be avoided in these areas where children are. But I think in other grave violations that we are seeing record levels of, and I think that's again something we need to be really very clear that we are seeing in the last reporting year 26,000 incidents of grave violations being recorded, and I think that's, you know, a very serious number. But that is, again, direct targeting of children, saying whether it's using children as child soldiers, whether it's you know, taking children away from their families. And we saw I think in particular with the ISIS, how they treated the Yazidi population, and as you know, taking away large numbers of children from them. And I think, again, that is a trend that we have a huge sort of armory of international laws and norms to protect against. But as the nature of conflict changes, they seem less able to sort of hold back this very dangerous tide.
Let's move a little bit then, because we're looking at NGOs now and civilian NGOs learning from the military. So you mentioned that there's a few things we can do to, although it's horrendous to talk about it, but to prevent this stuff, or at least hold it back with regards to the learnings from the military. What could we do to impact children in a positive way?
Yeah, and I think we need to be sort of very pragmatic when it comes to sort of operational responses to these. I mean, it's all very nice to say we wish to wake up tomorrow and see a world without conflict and no children being caught up in it. But I think realistically that's not the way things are going. So, and in fact, we need to be very sort of hard-headed about taking measures and taking preparation to better protect children. And I think, you know, militaries have spent billions of dollars and have spent, you know, incredible amounts of time and effort to protect their soldiers against explosive weapons, understandably so. And I think what we're seeing now, I mean, I always think to myself, you know, the internet was a byproduct of military research that now everyone takes advantage of, but that we're actually seeing increasingly the civilian domain learning from the military domain when it comes to protecting civilians from explosive weapons, treating them if they are affected by explosive weapons, and then helping them to recover in the longer term. So I think what you've seen with the sort of setup of the Pediatric Blast Injury Partnership, which Save the Children and Imperial College have helped to co-convene, is a great kind of loose coalition of actors that has allowed a lot of ex and serving military to come in and sort of bring their expertise to a different problem statement. And people like Dr. Paul Reevely, who's the pediatrician, who's the lead author of the Pediatric Blast Injury Field Manual, who served in Afghanistan with the British military and is now able to take the lessons that he learned from treating injured Afghan children on operation into the creation of a manual that can be used by non-pediatric specialist medics in conflict environments, I think is a good example of that. But looking further down the road, I mean, we could be looking at some really sort of slightly strange responses to these things that you'd almost think would come out of science fiction, but might be the kind of thing that we need to better protect children in modern conflict, whether that's children wearing, you know, school backpacks with Kevlar lining, or whether school buses are designed with V-shaped hulls or designed to potentially be ready to withstand an IED blast. I mean, it's all pretty strange kind of problems to be answering, but unfortunately they are of such a scale now that it's simply irresponsible not to be answering them. And I think there is huge potential to learn from military actors around this area of work that they've obviously had their own unique experience of. And I think there's already a lot of sort of positive operational learnings coming
in the last few years. 10 that. Years, we've seen a big shift. Could you talk about the stats?
Yes, so I think that, you know, I mentioned the current stat of 25 children a day killed or maimed on average, and that comes from UN data that reveals that 93,000 children have been killed or maimed in the last decade. And I have to sort of caveat that data that is likely a significant underreporting. I mean, we do always struggle with how casualties are being recorded, how sort of, especially in sort of farther flung parts of the world, if a large bomb goes off and affects a large group of people, is the data from what's happened to all those people going into these kind of monitoring and reporting mechanisms? And I don't think it is. So I think this large number, this 25 children killed or maimed every day, is unfortunately an underreporting. And I think that's something that we all need to get a lot better at. I think, especially if you're looking at modern militaries fighting wars from the air, who are not able to sort of do that kind of after action analysis in throughout the rubble to understand what level of effect weapons have had. I think casualty recording and having the highest possible casualty recording standards is something that everyone should look to adopt. But I think that number of killed or maimed is part of a wider picture of the number of children living in high-intensity conflicts continuing to rise. So I think we've now got around 160 million children living in high-intensity conflicts today, and 426 million children living in conflict areas overall. So that's the second highest number ever recorded. But these numbers are just so vast, they almost don't mean anything. But behind what I would stress to all of your listeners is that behind each of those horrible stats is a story. It's a little boy in the back of an ambulance. It's a little girl lying dead on a beach. And unfortunately, that is what these.
It's hard to describe
mean.
It really when you know, especially when you've got your own children or you've got close family that are young to think of them being in such a vulnerable position and your government and the organizations around you doing little or unable to do as much as they'd like because of funds and all the rest of it. And we haven't mentioned the field manual that went out, but that's such a small priced and simple thing to do, yet it's got such a big impact. But let's talk about the bigger scheme here. Let's look at policy. What's happening globally to reduce the risk of munitions and conflict to children?
Yeah, well, I hope I haven't sort of painted too bleak a picture. And I think there's always a danger when you sort of kind of roll out some of these findings that it can kind of engender a degree of hopelessness. But I would really then point to that there is a huge kind of community and coalition of concern who are pushing back on this. Those both formally in terms of whether they're working for organizations who have kind of got it in their mandate. But I think more generally than that, and certainly within the UK, I think the British public are not just horrified by kind of what conflict can do to children, but want to do stuff practically to respond to that. And I think we're continually seeing that. So I think this isn't sort of just a passive sort of a horrible thing that we can do nothing about. And I think there's no better example of some of the where some of the real hope is going forward than the Irish-led political declaration that's being put together. It's been somewhat delayed by COVID and the pandemic, but they're hoping to launch this in Dublin next year and hopefully have a large number of states be at that initial point of endorsement to commit to recognizing the harm that we've just talked about to civilians from these weapons, and also thinking about how we can practically take steps to develop operational policies and measures to sort of protect civilians better and to stop these trends continuing to head in the direction they are. And of course, this has been done before. It's been done with very practical terms when it comes to the disarmament world, to cluster munitions and to landmines like the ones you spoke about earlier. This is a more complicated issue, I would suggest, but it's one I think that an increasingly large group of states are recognizing is of such strategic importance, because it doesn't come back just to that story of that child who I spoke about at the beginning, who was hit by that IED that then changed the course of their life, both immediately and into the future. You know, destroying cities and cities being destroyed in order to win them. And I'd point your listeners to the Netflix Mosul film that's coming out this Friday, actually, which is, I think, going to be a vivid depiction of what modern urban warfare can look like and how incredibly desperate it is for civilians. But destroying these cities also has a longer term strategic cost to it. And I think whether it's in terms of displacement or refugees, we have the largest number of refugees today than any point since World War II. And I think that, you know, these things are all joined up. And I think this declaration that the Irish are leading on, and I hope that states like the UK, who have been very positive in the process so far, can engage with further and endorse, I think can be really, you know, practical ways of pushing back. And it's not about introducing new law and new IHL and sort of new restrictions, if you will, to how militaries operate. I think it's just about recognizing the type of harm that's being kind of being wrought in one conflict and devising these kind of creative coalitions that can kind of come up with very, very practical operational policy to
the
to
I mean you just mentioned there the film that's coming out, Mosul, and but it's been in our modern day media for a long time, these depictions of, I suppose, using things like teddies in full metal jacket as IEDs, and there's a lot of work, people like Mal Grister is a good friend of mine who's a videographer and filmmaker, and media like podcasts like this will get the word out and will change things, you know, globally with policy, but on a micro level with things like this. And there's loads more information on savethechildren.org.uk. Dave, can you talk me through your injury?
Yep. So I was injured in February 2011. I was serving as a Royal Engineer in Afghanistan at the time. I'd stood on an IED, which we'd failed to find, and it ended up ripping both of my legs apart. I was casuvac'd off the ground within 20 minutes. Within 37 minutes from injury, I was on the surgeon's table at the field hospital in Camp Bastion. And then 36 hours post-injury, I was medevac'd back to the UK on an RAF flight straight to Birmingham, where I was blue-lighted to the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham. I spent a week in intensive care before a further 4 weeks on the early rehabilitation ward, the military ward at that hospital, before being transferred for rehabilitation down at the Defence Medical Rehabilitation Centre at Headley Court, where I spent the next 3 years in and out of rehab, learning to do everything again, learning to walk, cook, live, clean, run, right from you know, all the way from beginning to end. So I guess talking a little bit more through the injury, I was crossing a compound which we were tasked to clear. I'd just crossed it to go and get a visual of the infantry unit which we were working with at the time. I turned around and walked back across this compound, and that's when I stood on the IED. I was blown a couple of meters up into the air as, you know, an 80 kilogram adult, came back down, landed on my head, and sort of sat myself up, and my legs were in tatters in front of me. Natural reaction was to scream. I was pretty shocked by the sight in front of me. And within 30 seconds, my soldiers were with me, where they applied a tourniquet to both of my legs to stop the blood from leaking out of me. They gave me morphine, so pain medication, within about 2 minutes. So the pain was never that intense. And I think within about 5 minutes, they'd radioed for the helicopter. So the helicopter was on its way. So that's the casualty evacuation helicopter. So that was en route. They'd phoned using our satellite phone, my own HQ, to let them know what had happened, to make the necessary arrangements back in Camp Bastion. So I spent probably about 10 minutes of the 20 minutes of waiting for the helicopter, sort of in distracted conversation with my soldiers while we waited for this helicopter to come in. But within 2 to 3 minutes, my life had been saved by the immediate actions of my team on the ground. So it was important. I was within that platinum 10 minutes. I'd hardly lost comparatively any blood, and the evacuation team was en route. Once the helicopter had touched down, I was prepared for surgery almost as soon as I was within reach of the helicopter. So there's a consultant anesthetist on the back of the helicopter who provided me with the right kind of anesthesia. So I was unconscious. And then on the helicopter flight back to Camp Bastion, they made sure that I was stable and gave me that immediate care, which is probably of a slightly higher level than you would see in an ambulance in the UK. So I was very much prepped. So I was cleaned, stripped, prepared for the surgeon's table. When we touched down in Camp Bastion, I was met by a military ambulance unit and taken from the helicopter into the field hospital in Camp Bastion, which is probably one of the best, if not the best, trauma hospital in the world at that point in time, where I was placed straight into the operating theatre, where the initial amputations of my legs were done and any further treatment I required for critical stabilisation, all of that took place. So we're talking 37 minutes I was on that table, which is absolutely astonishing. So they saved my life again in that hospital, made sure that I was stable. And in fact, I was stable enough that that evening I was conscious. So I was one of the few that was never put into an induced coma. That's a huge testament to the level of care which I was provided with, both on the ground, in the helicopter, and then in the operating theater in Afghanistan. So 36 hours after I was injured, I was on the flight back to the UK. And the only reason it took 36 hours was because I was not an emergency. So I was considered stable enough to not need to be rushed back to go to intensive care, where they've got more facilities back in the UK. So I was put on the Medivac flight back. So this is almost a flying operating theater in itself, perhaps not quite that grandiose, but I was accompanied by a paramedic for the entire flight back home. And then on arrival back to the UK at that airbase in Birmingham, again, met by an ambulance and was blue lighted straight into the hospital in Birmingham, where I had many further operations over a period of 7 days in intensive care before I spent 4 weeks on the early rehabilitation ward. On this ward, they teach you all about balance, about how to use a wheelchair. They talk you through your injuries. You get early psychological support, and you're placed in a ward with other soldiers if it's appropriate. So you can actually share the experiences together. You get this peer-based rehabilitation right from the start. After those 4 weeks, again, it was down to Headley Court for the later stages of rehabilitation. And as I said, here is where they teach you everything about your new life as an amputee. They teach you wheelchair skills. They teach you how to cook and clean in a wheelchair, and they progress you onto prosthetics. So for me, I was on prosthetics within 8 days of arriving at Headley Court. And then they teach you all those lessons again. They teach you how to cook, how to clean, how to walk on these prosthetics. They put you through career management, help you identify what your career targets are. They take you through all of your fitness exercises. So from 8 a.m. until 4 p.m, you're either doing physiotherapy, occupational therapy, or physical exercise to get you fit enough to be able to use the prosthetics properly. And then when you're finally considered to be of a sufficient level of rehabilitation, you're pushed out back into the big wide world, although there's no rush for this. So it really was an incredibly comprehensive I would say, gold standard of care that I received, right from the point at which I was blown up on the ground to the point of coming out the back end of rehabilitation. It was gold standard. Everything was looked after for me.
I mean, you were there as a professional soldier. You was in Afghanistan as a professional soldier. You stood on explosives that essentially blew you up. But right from the off, you know, within that first 2 days, you'd probably hit five or six different medical treatment, right the way from that immediate trauma care to being blue lit in Birmingham to the intensive care and rehab thereafter. It's that segue now between this and what we're going to. You had every opportunity, which led to, you know, Paralympics and then a PhD. What is the current situation with regards to kind of children who experience similar injuries? And are they getting the same or similar to what you got?
So I was incredibly fortunate with my injuries. I was in the right profession at the right time to go about, to get the right level of care that I needed to give me not just the optimal chance for survival, but the optimal chance for thriving afterwards. So everything that was done to me from point of injury onwards was all about saving my life, immediately followed by giving me the best possible quality of life afterwards. So that's what I mean by when I say I was in the, I was lucky to be in the profession that I was when that happened to me. For a civilian or a child caught up in the same situation, it can be very different. If you're fortunate, and if you're in somewhere like Afghanistan where the military are operating and someone is around to see to see that child step on a bomb, then you will get evacuated back to the field hospital, and you will receive a similar level of initial treatment. But those cases are few and far between. The likelihood is, if you're a child, you have been out playing with your friends and you have either stood on an improvised explosive device, you've stood on a legacy landmine, or you've picked up some form of munition and it's gone off in your hands and has either killed or injured you and the entire group of friends that you're with. You know, there is a case study of 9 children that were brought into a hospital in Afghanistan, and 2 of those children were triple amputees and 5 of them were double amputees. So 3 of them were triple amputees and 5 of them were double amputees. You know, the scale of injury when it happens to children is just astonishing. So if they're in that situation in the middle of nowhere, they're playing in a field with their friends, if they're lucky enough to survive, then they need someone to take them to a hospital, which is likely going to be some distance away, 1-2 hours minimum. And that's if you're lucky enough to have a car or some form of transport around. So you see some of these children with these level of injuries, which we've got, they're being dragged into a hospital, you know, 1-2 days after these kind of injuries. And if they're still alive at this point, then they'll get further treatment, they'll get their wounds tidied up, and again, if they're lucky, they'll go through some form of humanity and inclusion program or International Committee of the Red Cross program, where they'll get fitted with some form of basic prosthetic and then pushed back out into the big wide world. At this point, they are incredibly disabled. They are entirely reliant on their caregivers, you know, whether that's their family or friends or anyone who's taken enough pity on them to look after them. And that is it. They do not get rehabilitation to any great extent. If they're lucky, they will get prosthetics, but the likelihood is they'll get sent home with a set of crutches, and that's it. That's how they live the rest of their life.
And then, I mean, you mentioned it there, like you talk about being lucky. So they're the lucky ones, and they manage to get to a hospital where there's some care, that immediate care. But places around the world where there isn't a military infrastructure in place and there isn't, westernized hospitals and caregivers, what's happening to those children?
Well, the reality in most of these cases where there's not hospital treatment available is that these kind of injuries, blast injuries on children, the use of explosive weapons on children, whether deliberate or legacy, will result in the death of that child. If you have an amputation and you don't get the immediate level of first aid, which I got, you know, you don't stop the bleeding, you don't get a tourniquet on that leg, then that child will die. That is the long and short of it. If that child is lucky enough to have some form of treatment and that bleeding is stopped and they get taken to a hospital and they get onward care, then that child has a chance. But if they don't get this care, then they won't survive.
Mm. So then if you're looking at things like opportunity, what can be done to provide that for a child post injury if they do survive?
There's programs which have been developed in, you know, the partnership between Imperial College and Save the Children, for example. The Pediatric Blast Injury Partnership has taken a huge amount of has taken huge steps to improve the way that children are treated in the first place. So they've created the Pediatric Blast Injury Field Manual, which teaches people in a very straightforward way. It's been translated into 5 different languages now, how to treat children on the ground. So this is a freely available resource. You can download it in PDF format off the internet for free. And there's hard copies being distributed en masse around the place. So hopefully we can give people a basic level of education, particularly in these heavy conflict, these protracted conflict areas where children are getting blown up all of the time, so that immediate first aid treatment can be provided, so that people know the basics of stopping the bleeding, preventing bleeding out, so that child can be transferred to a hospital. So there's great steps being taken in this initial, you know, that first 10 minutes, that first period where that critical care is exactly that, so critical.
You know, we've spoke a little bit about the kind of negative aspect of this, but we've missed the fact that children are resilient, and resilience meaning that ability to bounce back. If given the opportunity, are we seeing children thrive with their injury, with their disability?
You do see children thrive with these kind of injuries. You're right. But at the minute, the number of children that are thriving is far too few. The reality is, if you get this level of injury, your ability to access society in general is hugely diminished. So for a child, that means your ability to access whatever form of education is available is diminished. Your ability to access healthcare is diminished. Your ability to access sanitation is diminished. So without the necessary treatment afterwards, you know, these children are really going to struggle. As Emily has alluded to earlier on in the podcast, if that child can get to education, they have a future. If they were unfortunate enough to be injured before they could learn to read, before they could learn to write, then their future does not look positive.
Mate, if we look at then, because you're working in, and you're going to talk about that in a second now, is in, if we take away any kind of secondary injury, if we take away any kind of psychological trauma and a traumatic brain injury or anything like that can happen beyond this, what needs to be done, what is being done, and what in the future are you going to do?
Okay, so there's a huge amount of work going into first off, saving those lives. So I know I've painted a little bit of a bleak picture, you know, during my time here today, but there's a huge amount of work going in to make sure that children get that life-saving first aid as and where they can. You know, this is going on as we speak. People are learning to save these lives. So that's one positive which should be taken from this. What we're working on at Imperial College is what happens when a child has an amputation. What happens when someone in a conflict zone, in a post-conflict zone, in a low-resource setting gets an amputation? How can we make sure that they have the best possible chance to live a normal, fruitful, positive life afterwards? So we know from experience of over the last 100 years that children get caught in the middle of war. We know this. And, you know, whilst the politicians are making strides to try and minimize the exposure risk for children to conflict, at the minute it's happening. So as a priority, we must protect the child victims of war that come out the other side. So for me, I'm looking at children with amputations. How can we make sure that child amputees from conflict have the best possible outlook afterwards? So for me, that means getting the critical mobility care that a child needs as far forward as possible. So for example, in many contemporary conflict zones, where the child is geographically located is often very far away from where you know, whatever scarce rehabilitation facilities are available. So there's a huge distance, and in the distance between those two locations may well be ongoing conflicts. So often the child is separated from the rehabilitative, the mobility care that they need. So priority one is deploying that mobility care as far forward as possible, so even children in the most remote areas have a chance of accessing some form of prosthetic device so that they can go about their normal day-to-day business. The second is understanding exactly what it is to me, exactly what it means to be a child amputee. The key thing about children is that they're still growing. And this is a huge issue when it comes to prosthetics. And this is not just in the conflict zone. This is all over the world. Children are still growing, which means that their bones are still growing, which means very soon after you fit them with a prosthetic, it doesn't fit anymore. And that's in the best case scenario. So we need to make prosthetics that are capable of being adjusted so that they can grow with the child. And this doesn't mean taking them to a specialist clinician. This means their mum, their dad, their big brother, big sister, whoever it is that's with them at home, can take a screwdriver out of their toolbox and adjust their prosthetic as that child grows so that that child's life is interrupted as little as possible as they move forward for it. So those are the real key priorities. Get them the prosthetic as soon as possible. And if that means going to them with a prosthetic, that's what we need to do. Getting them the right prosthetic, that means the prosthetic grows with them and allows them to function as best as possible. Those are the key things. That's when the resilience of the child comes in. If you can provide them with the ability to access the things that they need to access, so they're not reliant on a caregiver, they're not reliant on their mum or their dad or their brother, whatever it might be, then that child will be able to go to school if a school exists. They'll be able to go to that school. They'll be able to go and get whatever education it is. As they grow older, they can go to work. They're not destined for this poverty cycle that you see in so many disabled children. Their energy and their potential can then be directed into activating their own recovery.
Dave, in February 2011, you were searching for explosives, you were searching for IEDs. The work you're doing now, amongst all those other, amongst all, you know, the Centre for Blast Injury Studies and Imperial and Save the Children, you're all doing so much. I kind of blindside you with this question, as you know, I'm asking you as a friend, and a friend of the podcast and a personal friend, like, what's motivating you to, and what drives you with the work you do now?
Well, I don't like being an amputee. That's probably one of the key drivers from the very early days. So I'll wind it back a little bit. When I first got fitted with my full-size prosthetics, I was shocked at the comparison between these new prosthetic legs and the legs which I used to have, my real legs. The difference is chalk and cheese. I was naive in thinking that this is the 21st century and the legs would be much more of a direct replacement. So when I realized that they weren't, that's when I knew I needed to dedicate myself to making these things better. And then I realized how good I've got it in the UK compared to people in other parts of the world. So that was another huge motivator. And I also have kids. I've got three kids now, three little girls. And the thought of them being in the situation, which so many children, you know, the latest figures are something like 463 million children around the world live in conflict zones. The numbers are horrific. And it doesn't take much Googling to find images and videos of children with horrific injuries from conflict, from blast injuries. And it doesn't take much to put your own child in the position of that child that you've seen on the news. So I want to do everything I can to make sure that these kids have the best possible outcome. You know, I was fortunate when I was in Afghanistan that I never had to see the child victim of war. I never had to see it firsthand, although obviously I was aware all around me, and I was fortunate to just miss it. But children did come to my checkpoint. They came to my checkpoint to collect Wellington boots and colouring pencils, like they did from so many other checkpoints. And the images, those children's faces, those kids that I met that we played with in the courtyard of this checkpoint, are what I see when I think about children of conflict, when I think about the injuries which these children are sustaining. And I don't want to see that for anyone. At least if I can do a little bit to provide some positivity, some potential for a better outcome for these children, then I think I'm doing okay.
Dave, Emily, James, thank you so much, and we will leave it there.